I ended up to do bike races because my father also ride a lot of the bike. Later, I went to university in Aachen to start medical engineering. And still at the weekends, I went to Belgium, Holland, Germany around to do the races. I was not the best cyclist, so I was in a medium, and I was thinking, how could I train better to improve my performance? And being on the study as an engineer, I was thinking, okay, what describes your performance? Is it your heart rate? Is it how fast you can ride? And I came to the point, no, it's the power you can produce. I think it's soon they will use electric bikes. It will come maybe in a way that you are allowed to carry an X amount of battery. And then at the start line, maybe all the batteries are empty. So then the challenge would be in the race to charge the battery of your bike with your own energy. So then the team should get maybe the team leader as economic as at the point where it counts. And then he can use the additional energy, his own energy, that is stored on the bike.
Juli, it's good to see you. I wanted to do this discussion with you. You are the founder of the cycling power meter all the way back to the 1986, I believe. So yeah, it's exciting to have this discussion.
88 around this year, yes.
86, 88. Shall we start from that? How did you, first of all, how did you come with the idea and how did you start developing?
You know, at that time, a lot of young people, they did a lot of sports. I would say more competitive sports than they do now. And I started as a normal guy doing soccer, maybe swimming. I ended up to do bike races because my father also ride a lot of the bike. And I was maybe around 15. That every weekend, Saturday, Sunday, some races. And later I went to university in Aachen to start medical technique or medical engineering. And still at the weekends, I went to Belgium, Holland, Germany around to do the races. I was not the best cyclist, so I was in a medium, and I was thinking, how could I train better to improve my performance? And being on the study as an engineer, I was thinking, okay, what describes your performance? Is it your heart rate? Is it how fast you can ride? And I came to the point, no, it's the power you can produce. And then I was thinking, okay, what is the power? The power is two things. On the bicycle is more or less how hard you push the pedals and how fast you push the pedals. So you have to measure two parameters. The one is the force of the pedal, and the other is, let's say, the cadence. Or on the bike, the force multiplicated with the crank length is the torque. And the cadence is more or less the angular velocity in technical words. So I was thinking, okay, I studied all the training books, and it's easy maybe in running or in swimming to measure the performance, because there the outside environment is more stable. On the bicycle, you have flat, you have headwind, you have backwind, you have climbs, you can beat the draft. So the speed doesn't tell you that much how strong you are. So you need to have the power. You need to measure the power. This tells you exactly how strong you are. And when you know your body weight or also maybe your aerodynamic coefficients, you can easily calculate how fast you can ride and how strong you are. So I said, okay, on the bike, how can I measure the power? And the first point is, like when your foot touches the pedal, the bike is the pedal. Then from the pedal, the force goes to the pedal spindle. Then it goes to the both cranks, then it goes to the axle, then it goes to the chain rings, to the chain, to the BB, with the spokes, to the rear tire. So there's a long chain where the force or the power goes on the road. At that time, I was thinking, okay, it's easiest maybe put some strain gauges on the cranks, measure the bending of the cranks, and then see how good you are. But when you look back in the 80s, it was not easy. There was ANT, Bluetooth, this all was not existent. Even not a bike computer was existent. So I said, okay, the cranks, you need to dismount, it's difficult. I did on the cranks, did also on the pedals. And then I was thinking, there need to be a better point. Then the first point on the bike, where all the forces come together, is the piece that's between the pedal spindle and the chain rings. It's called now spider. So I said, okay, I need to measure the power in the spider, because there, left and right leg is already added, and I measure there only what goes to the J, because all the not wanted forces do not exist there. Like, you can stand on the pedal, you have no force on the J. As long as you start a power, then you get force on the J. So I start creating devices, putting strain gauge on the so-called spider. And so, okay, then I had a problem. How can I transmit the data? Because you had not yet that Bluetooth or AAT. So we described, we developed our own protocol. More or less, this was with a coil. This was a similar system also what Polar uses at the first heart rate monitors. Now you have a coil that transmits data to a receiver on the frame. We did this, I think, more than 20 years for our power meters. So I developed a way to transmit the data from the spider to the frame. And that also a little bike computer that was able to show and store the data with a software. At that time was MS-DOS, Windows was not existent, to see the data on a computer. So racing on the weekend, going there with a big computer on the handlebar, this was the size of, let's say, at that time of a Game Boy, the other cyclists were laughing, what does he has there? Who needs a bicycle computer? Then one had one race, I run in a pothole, the computer fell off the handlebar, I stopped in the race, picked the pieces up, put it back in the jersey, went back in the race, and the other was laughing, ah, he picked up his bike computer, but no one needs. So anyway, but being on the weekend at races, I was able to see or meet also very good guys. They were in a national team. And I spoke with the coach of that region in Germany. Well, he asked me to, this would be interesting for our cyclists to use on the track, to use on the velodrome. So this is the way then I got in touch with, at that time, the best cyclist. And then all it was time for me to go to military. At that time, it was mandatory. Every guy in Germany had to do a 1 year, a 1.5 year military. And I was able to go in the sports company, working with athletes, using my instrument to prove their performance. And so then right away, I was able to work with the best German athletes. They trained for Olympic Games. I think the first Olympic Games there was in Barcelona. This was maybe 92 or something. Yep. At the first world championship, they used this was in Japan, in Meibashi. But at that time, also the, was still existed East Germany. So we had East and West Germany. This was before the reunion. So also for the East German guys, they used this on the road in the 100-kilometer team time trial. But then the first world championship was 91. This was in Stuttgart. There was both nations together, so only one national team. So I started working with the national teams, with the German national team mainly, till the Olympic Games in Atlanta. But at the same time, I started also working because when you go to the events, when you go in the training camps, you see the other nations. I met the guy, the US national coach. His name was Chris Carmichael. He later was the coach of Armstrong. So he said, ah, Uli, this would be good. We have the next Olympic Games in Atlanta. Would be good to help the mountain bikers. So at the same time, I worked a little bit with the US mountain bikers. At that time, the US mountain bike coach was Dee Goodage. And they used this for mountain biking at the pre-Olympic races in Atlanta. And so I had easy, very quick access to very good athletes. At the same time, also by journalist to Greg LeMond, who was the first best cyclist, the Tour de France winner, who tried the system. He also did 1 year the Giro d'Italia, Milan San Remo, with this equipment. And so I got, yeah, it was then for the best who were smart, they used it. But also in the same time, you know, I live close to Cologne. There was a part of the German Space Agency, and they had a cooperation in Italy with the University in Udine. There was a professor, his name was Di Pramparo. He was responsible for the fitness for the Russian cosmonauts in the space station Mir. And he said, we need an instrument that measures the decrease of performance when you're in space with no gravity. So I went to Udine. We developed a device that could go on the space station. And there I met the guys from the university in Ferrara. They worked at that time for the UCI for their research. So I got very quick also then access to all the Italian athletes like Gianni Bugno, and then they trained the Dutch guys that were training in Italy, like Rolf Sørensen, Jan Ries, Michele Bartol lives in Lucca. So this was the way also to get closer to Italy, and more or less also the reason now why I live in Italy two part of the year. So that's more or less the way the start of the system was. And then when you go back at the quantity, was not that much, but it was only built for national teams and professionals. And at that time, they bought. So a professional like Rolf Sørensen bought this, as I am, and used this sometimes for 10 years for the whole career. Maybe he bought two systems and he put it from one bike to the next bike to the next bike to the next bike. And the bike was done, but as I am, he kept. Now it's different. Now a professional, not me, but from other companies, they get money to use their product. At that time, not.
So basically, you came up with the idea. You use first principles to build the device itself, and then it was such a good device that actually everybody wanted to use it. What I'm wondering is, first of all, like, how did you approach it from a business perspective? Like, as in, did people and did the athletes pay you enough for those sensors, or did you have to do something else at the same time?
So at the start, I did everything alone. Later, I got other people who helped me to design a computer. I'm not the best guy making a computer. I'm good at mechanic, like develop strain gauges, develop the mechanic devices. And then also guys who developed the software to evaluate the data. But the price of the system, I think the first system I already put up for maybe 5,000 or 6,000 German marks, what is right now around 3,000 euro. So I know it cannot be cheap, because I know the amount of work and what this all costs. And I know, okay, I need to have a certain price to survive. And I made in the first years maybe 200 systems a year. And they all hand-built by me. And I delivered to the athletes, and the quality was good. So a system I built, they were able to use 4 or 5 years. So it was not finished after 1 year or 2 years. So, and then people want two and they paid. There was not a discussion about this. It was for them like a tool. Like you are, let's say, a good cook, you buy the best knives. Or something where you're a designer, you want a good computer, and you buy your computer to do good work. And that time, this was the method, not of all professionals, but with the professionals I worked with. They gave me the money and they bought. It was not I was at the national teams they bought, because they wanted to win medals at the Olympics and they need good tools. So this was not a problem. It got later a problem because also I was able to get a patent for this. I think it expired 2008, because from that point, the patent expired, because it was based power meter for a crank drive. A lot of others start copying. And then the market got flooded with more or less copies, but then also with power meters, they should not use the name power meter. And now I think if you make a market research, maybe you find 20 different power meters on the market. And I do not know if they all make really good business and can survive, because some are already gone, disappeared. Like if you look at PowerTap, where are they? Look at Pioneer, where is Pioneer? Hegemo. So I don't know. We have to see what goes.
Longevity of a business is a very different question in a very competitive environment, I guess. If you think back, you mentioned that you're using I believe MS-DOS. The interesting part to hear about is, how did the bike computers change over time? Like, did at the beginning you have to, like, the user had to connect their PC, see all the data there, And it was very early stages of computers as well. And then how did this change? How did the product adapt based on that change of computers?
At the first, there was only SIM as a bike computer. There was no other. So you had the SIM power meter and the SIM bike computer. And you know, when you go back at the Tour de France 15 years ago, you had 80% of the riders, maybe 120, using SIM in the Tour de France, and only from us. Then the first competitor on the bike computer part was, I would say, Garmin. They made a quite good bike computer. Maybe it was not that good specific on training, but it has an option like navigation and GPS, what we did not have. We were only focused on training and show the data that improved the quality of the train. Because where I grew up, or the cyclists that were traditionally, no one needed a navigation on the bike computer. They know where to train. They were not traveling that much as they know what they do now. They trained at home and they know all the roads 200 kilometers around. So this was not needed. But right now, I would say, I do not know if it gets too much, but the bike computer gets more and more information. And at my point, sometimes this is overwhelming because it takes away the focus what is essential. And the essential of the training is as a body parameter, maybe your heart rate, and a physical parameter, your power. Then it's important, maybe the cadence, okay, it's like the RPM of the engine of a car. Then maybe important is the outside temperature, because also this has an influence on the performance. And then the time, how long you train. And then maybe also you could say the attitude is important. All the other values is maybe nice to have, like stress factor, TSS, left-right balance. Yep, plenty, plenty now. I think if you look at a Garmin, maybe there are 50 parameters or more. And people who start new have no idea. They do not really know what is important or not. And then you have so many coaches that tell you their stories, what is all needed. I said, I listen sometimes to them. I said, they forget mainly to look at the athlete first. What type of person is this? And then look at the data. Now they look first at the data and forget the athlete behind. They see them as a source of data, sit at home in their office, maybe see the athlete once a month or maybe never. And then they give their comments on training on everything and analyze only the data. I said, maybe it would be better to follow him on a scooter, go there and see this guy in the face like you do still at a soccer trainer. A soccer trainer is not sitting at home and gives the comments over the phone. No, he has to stand on the side of the field. The same with swim coach. But in cycling, I don't know. Okay, not all teams do this. But I know a lot of coaches, they're sitting at home and never see the athletes, only analyze data. And I do not know. I think the better teams are where the coach works closer to the athlete.
Yeah. Well, in early on, when the athletes started using the power meter, what was their goal? Was it to have a prolonged, sustained power over time and they were using it to measure that? Or was it a variation of power over their training?
Okay, you have to see at three things. Like, let's say you say sprint. Look at André Greipel or Mark Cavendish. For them, it's important after a six-hour race, five-hour race, to be able for maybe 20 seconds to push, let's say, depends on the weight, on the size, 1,600, 2,000 watts for them, for 20, 30 seconds. Maybe do this three, four times because sometimes you have three sprints before the finish. So their goal is to make it to the finish, save as much energy as possible to do the sprint. When you look to a guy like doing a time trial, Cancellara, for him it's important to have the highest possible power in relation to the aerodynamic coefficient. At him say, okay, if he knows I can do 1 hour, 480 watts, I get my champion. Because it's normally flat, the weight doesn't matter. If you look at the guy who wants a stage on a climb, like IPS, for him it's important to be able for that climb to do as much as possible watts per kilogram. but not only one time, because maybe before you come to the final climb, you have two or three climbs before. But then also you have to see what is a stage race guy and what is a classic guy. A classic guy need to be able at one day to spend as much as possible energy in at one day race. Doesn't matter how long it takes for a generation. A guy who wants to win the tour, the one day is important, but more important is the regeneration day by day by day, not to suffer day by day and get weaker and weaker. So there are different perspectives. So when you know this, and then you know what to look on the data, because when you have the data, you see, okay, how intense was this? You see also what, when I was looking at the data, is for me, where I can see if someone is tired or not, is the reaction of the heart rate to the change of power. If someone gets tired, the heart rate has a problem to follow the power. The heart rate doesn't want to go up. It's an indication that you are tired, that you are not regenerating well. Okay, it doesn't matter if at the next day you have no race. The rest day you can lay a day in the bed. But if the next day comes again a stage and again a stage and again a stage, this matters a lot. And then also knowing this for the training, you can look at this and can work on this to improve these parameters. Okay, you need maybe a smart coach who knows to look at this, but you can get the data out of this amount of data, what is important for this type of cyclist. It's not that difficult if you know what to look for. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. And then, Uli, like from, you mentioned that you were creating about 200 devices per year, but then...
At the start, yes.
So then how did you transition? Like, how did you build the team to manufacture much more over time?
Okay. Later, we were able, let's say Cannondale, they wanted to sell a bike, keep with a power meter. So we start making power meters for a bike, and people who order the Cannondale bike can order this right away with a power meter. Trek, because this came because the Cannondale teams, they had power meter in the team. Like it was the first one, Seiko Cannondale, and then later Liquid Gas, they had Cannondale. And then it was with Trek was the same. We were on Trek Project 1. So Trek wanted to sell bikes with a power meter. So then SRAM said, we need a power meter too. So we start making power meters for SRAM. So we built power meters for them. They put on their crank and were selling. So this ramped up the production. Now it's different because SRAM now makes their own power meter, the Quark. And then I think Shimano has their own power meter. Then a lot of have their own power meter. Maybe it's good or not good, but it's different.
Yeah.
But at that point, we made the power meters for all the others.
So these companies came to you in order for them to add the power meter there. But like from your team, like where were you manufacturing at the time? Like did you outsource
manufacturing? At that time, we made everything in Germany, but we also assembled, let's say, all the power meters for SRAM. They got assembled in Colorado. We have an office there. They worked at that time around 20 people, and they were assembling all the parts for the U.S. market. And the Spyder was also produced in Colorado. So the whole thing was built there.
Okay. How did you approach that? Did you fly to the U.S.? Did you build a team by yourself, or how did you?
I had, for the start, distributors. But then at one point, the distributors do not want to do the service, because after 2-3 years, the customers come and said, I need a battery change. I want, I need new chainings. I want a new calibration. And they told the customers, ship to Germany. And I told to the distributor, I didn't want to say the name, hey, maybe it's time you hire a mechanic, teach him to do this. And he said, no, if I hire a mechanic and teach him and invest into him, then he goes to the next company that pays him one cent more. He didn't want to do. I said, okay, I will lose all the U.S. market when I do not start to offer service there, because you cannot tell the people send over the ocean to Europe. So I went there and had to decide what to do. So I made a road trip, started in Seattle, San Francisco, down to San Diego, then to I said I was in Phoenix, Durango, Colorado Springs, Denver, and then also at the East Coast, and from New York down to Savannah. And then I said, okay, I spent time before in Colorado Springs working with USA Cycling for the Olympics. And also the German Federation went there several times for attitude training. So I know people there, and knowing people there helps a lot to start a business. So knowing, working with USA Cycling, I know the CEO of USA Cycling, I know the coaches. I said, hey, I think it's a nice place. It's not as expensive as Boulder, maybe the half price at that time. It was easy to find workers because also in Colorado Springs at that time was CTS. This was founded by Carmichael when he left USA Cycling. And this was quite popular coaching company, and they were selling our product. So I said, okay, I went there. I hired two people, but they quit. Then I went there with my wife and the kids and said, okay, we have to go there, stay 3 months to wrap up the business. And this worked pretty well. So this was not really, it's also, I have to say, in the US, it's not that difficult to start a business. Because you can, when you have an address, okay, you need to know what to do. First is you have to work, maybe to get a visa, a work visa. But there's a way, like I got an E2 investor visa. You have to show you want to invest money, then you get a visa. Then you can rent a house, then you can get a cell phone, then you can open a bank account and all these things. But I ask for the people, what are the right steps? And then you can settle down, because you cannot get a cell phone if you do not have a bank account. And if you have no address, you cannot get a bank account. So you need a lot of things done. But if you have one, then comes the next, and the next, and the next. And then you can also buy a car. Without an address, without a cell phone, you cannot buy a car without a bank account. But I managed all this. It was not that difficult.
Yeah, it's the same. It's the same situation today. So you mentioned Cannondale and Trek, that they came to you. Like, did they actually came to you? Like, did they learn from the athletes? Was this a word of mouth thing, or did you try to approach it?
No, the athletes come to me. I was one time in Munich. I got a call on my phone. Here's Mario Cipollini. I need your device. I want to get world champion. And I did not speak that well English, Italian. And I said, my mother was around. I said, can you speak to my mother? She speaks Italian, and she know where Mario Cipollini she gave him. They spoke Italian. I said, okay, I will build you a device. When I come next time to Lucca, you will get one, and we can handle this. But he called himself on my phone. The same like Froome or Armstrong, they take the phone and call me. I need your device. The same block. Yeah. But only a certain type of athletes. They are self-responsible. They know what they want. And Armstrong was a guy who knows what he wants, and he was in charge. Or Michele Bartoli, he was in charge. Or Gianni Bugno. These are guys, I would say, also right now, it's maybe more difficult, but there are some guys who are leaders. And they are self-responsible. Others not. They are empty shells. The coach, the team does everything for them, but some they are strong and manage themselves.
Let's go to the Lance Armstrong story, because I spoke to him a few days ago. We met together in Vegas. He's one of the investors of Terra, and
You ask him about me.
That's literally what I was about to say. Like I asked him about the parameters he mentioned. That was using your power meter. Can you tell us what that story, like how did you meet Lance and how did it work?
I think I came to a race in Belgium where he shared the room with Inkepi, and I explained him, but the meeting was set up, I would think, by Carmichael or by the team US Postal. I'm not sure. I went there and then I spent with the team and explained him. And he was happy to use. He always called me directly if he wanted something. Never told the other guy. He took his phone and called me. That's always nice.
And do you know how he used it over time? Like, how was he training?
He was not really interested to download the data analyze. He was looking on the bike computer and then knowing what he was doing. When he was doing intervals at the climbs, he was looking on the computer, okay, I push the watch I want. And then for him, when the training was over, it was history, not any more interesting. Not like later sit on the computer, analyze the data now. He wants the information instantaneous as an actual feedback in the training, and then say, okay, this was good. He knows this, basta. Not like others then recording and then later sitting hours and analyzing the data. This, he was by far not that guy.
Yeah. He was telling me this story that basically he was looking at two things. One, the power. The second, at his heart rate. And his goal was to keep his heart rate at 200 BPM, like unbelievable, for 1 hour straight and then 2 hours straight. And then he was trying to up the power based on his heart rate being so high all the times. I was like, how can you even do that? Like, how can you even go to 200 BPM for 1 hour straight? This is unbelievable. But this is exactly how he was using it.
Yeah, but you must have the genetic disposition to do this. Other cannot do this. Other is finished at 150,
60. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's extreme.
Also, the high cadence at that time he used. Now it gets more popular, but this was really smart of him because, you know, a race engine gets the high power by a high RPM of the engine because power is cadence multiplicated with force or with torque. So if you double the cadence, you can double the power and keep the force the same because the force is limited to your muscles. But when you increase the cadence, you can easier get up a higher power. But to have this high cadence, we need much more oxygen. And you need to train this. But he was one of the first who was able to do this attack and then keep a high cadence up with the high power to the top. And the other were pushing the bigger gears and they get... And also with a higher cadence, if you are trained, I think it's less stress for the muscle. But now they do similar things now.
Yeah. Uli, how did the product change over time? Like, how did you improve the product over the years?
So, the first, the power meter was only measuring the torque, the cadence. Our actual power meter now, and sending with a coil, the power meter we have now can send the data ANT Bluetooth. As a memory inside, can be paired to a heart rate belt, can be paired to a speed sensor, and is rechargeable. It's much more complex, but at the end provides the same data as a power meter 30 years ago. Because it's nice to have a memory in the power meter, because then you need not necessarily head unit. But for example, on the track or a cycle cross race, this may be better, even for mountain bike race, because you cannot really look on the head unit. So if the data is in the power meter, it's safe. And then also what the power meter now can do is they can store the data with a high resolution. That means 200 signals per second. That means you can analyze the stroke after the training. See how you were pedaling, how over the time you get tired, what has changed in the pedal stroke. This you can do now, but the most people use the power meter as a daily instrument simply to record the power and cadence, and not the same way as they did it 30 years ago, not more. And only a few use all the options, the possibilities the power meter is able to do. And also what is different now, we have a very high variety of power meters. Let's say I made special power meters for Ineos. There are two guys who are allowed to use it, Pitcock and Paulina. They can use our power meters and they're very happy. Then we make this a mountain bike power meter. And then we made power meters for all the other teams, like in the past, Campagnolo power meter for Lotto, for all these teams. Then we made Shimano power meter for all the other teams. They use Shimano. Then we made FSA power meter. Then we made Canada power meter for our own power meter with our own crank. And we have our own crank systems, cheap ones in aluminium and very expensive ones in carbon and then composite material. And then we have power meter track, mountain bike road, and then all the different spindles. We have 24 millimeter spindle for Shimano BBs, 29 millimeter for the SRAM, and then 30 millimeter for BB30 in all different lengths. It's a motor system. So you can select, okay, a track power meter with a 30 millimeter spindle, and that are the crank lengths. It's modular now, not 160. And I think others do the same now.
Yeah. Uli, when if you had to advise entrepreneurs that they are building today hardware sensors very similar to measure more data and so on, how would you advise them? What do they need to do? What do they need to be thinking?
To measure the hardware, but what to measure what?
Any kind of hardware for the bike itself, no specific kind of hardware.
So what is important at my point? Where to put in the most money? Or what? For me personally, I would say you do not need the electric shifting. This is something that makes it more difficult. It's, you have to worry about more and more battery charging. Other people would say, no, it's so nice, you need not a force, it's so easy. I said, okay, but if the battery of the shifting is empty, you cannot ride a bike. If the battery of the bike computer is empty, you can still ride your bike. So then I think what is a nice thing now that you have tires with a bigger diameter. Like when I was racing, the guy said 19 millimeter is the best. Then you get up to 23 millimeter, 25, 28. And now sometimes they have 30 millimeter tires. They're almost the double size as 30 years ago. Then the wheels, they get much better. Composite wheels, very strong. In the frames, the main difference is they get more aerodynamic. You get all the cables in the frame, but that makes the service more difficult, but everything looks clean. But I think for a daily ride, and if you do not care about aerodynamics, maybe it's better to have a bike where you have easy access to all the things, like outside, easier maintaining. Then the disc brakes, a lot of guys says it's so nice, and others says that the disc brakes need to be forbidden because they are too aggressive. If you're riding behind a guy with a disc brake and he touches you with no reaction time, it's so quick that you will crash right away in the wheel. And then on bad weather, it's much more difficult to put the right dose, not to block the wheels. Because with a rim brake and you do a descent in poor rain, there comes a corner, you know, okay, it's maybe now to start braking to get the rim clean, to have the right brake force at the curve. But with a disc brake, you hit just before. And if you have not the right sensitivity, you're on the ground. This is what professionals tell me, that the safety got less with the disc brakes when you ride in the group, not alone in the group, because it's more difficult to control.
Awesome. And then for the last question, I wanted to ask you, what do you think is the future of the space within the next 5 years and 10 years? What
would you expect? I think not now. I think it's soon. It will come that also at the Tour de France and others, they will use electric bikes. And I think it will come maybe in a way that you are allowed to carry an X amount of battery. And then at the start line, maybe all the batteries are empty or fully, all should have the same. And then you are allowed to have a motor. I do not know if it will be limited with a certain torque, because this depends then on the weight of the cyclist, or of if they say, we don't care about the strength of the motor, anything, it need be only the energy you can store in the bike. And then I also do not know if they say, this depends also on your weight, how heavy you are or not, or they give everything open, and only it's the rule at the start, everything need to be empty. We don't worry how much you have, but no energy should be stored on the bike. So then the challenge would be in the race to charge the battery of your bike with your own energy, because there's no energy at the start. So then the teams should get maybe the team leader as economic as at the point where it counts. Then he can use the additional energy, his own energy, that is stored on the bike. for whatever he wants to do. Many you have similar things already in Formula One, where you have a boost mode and others. I think the electric industry, electric bikes, will want this to push this. This is what I think. But to make the regulation is maybe difficult. And I think maybe at my point, the easiest is if you say at the start line, all empty, and then it's up to them to put in. We can make a lot better reef, but then the bike gets heavier and you need longer to charge. So it's up to you. So this would give a lot of freedom for the engineering. And then the helpers need to get the guy in the draft that he always puts a little energy in his battery, that at the final climb, the battery is maybe full. And then you would see they go up with IPS with 50 kilometers an hour.
Yeah.
And the sparks will come out of the sprockets. I think maybe it would be interesting for the spectators too.
Yeah, that would be super interesting. Excellent. Uli, thanks so much. It's been a great discussion. Thanks so much for this.
I thank you for the time and enjoy the weekend in San Francisco.